Hello, my name is Rich Jones. I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and the Chief Clinical Officer of U-Turn Health, and I'm also a co-host of this wonderful podcast.
And my name is Liz, and I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and a co-host of You Learn, You Turn.
And let's get the show on the road.
Welcome to another edition of You Learn, You Turn. I'm Hamilton Baden, co-founder and CEO of U-Turn. And today I am very happy to introduce you to our guest, Craig Carton. Craig, how you doing, buddy?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm good. And for those of you who have never seen this, there's no rules here. I probably cuss way too freaking much. So, Craig, you can say whatever the hell you want to say. Craig, give you a little bit of background. U-Turn is a company that myself and Rich Jones founded, really to kind of change the face of behavioral health in this country. Unfortunately for 70 years, the way we've treated this stuff is we wait for people to hit bottom and then they raise their hand and ask for help, which is what happened to me. And so there's no rules here. Just would love to hear a little bit about, you and your story. And I'm sure, and for full disclosure to all the viewers here, Craig and I are phenomenal friends. We've been friends since we were young punks running around Philadelphia. How old were we, Craig? 23, something like that?
I first picked you up at that bar in 1994, I want to say. So we were about 25, 26, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of fun. So Craig, just introduce yourself. Tell us your background, your story, what you do, and we'll get into all the details.
Yeah, I mean, the background is for the last 30 years, I've been employed as a radio host, a TV host, starting in Buffalo, New York back in 91, and Cleveland, Ohio from 92 to 93. And, you know, went to about five or six different markets in the country, was nationally syndicated, et cetera. And then over the course of a long period of time, I wound up my most successful and most well-known job was I did mornings at WFAN in New York City. And was blessed to have the most listened to, watched, you know, morning sports talk show in the country. Boomer Esiason, the former Cincinnati Bengal, Jet and Cardinal, was my co-host. And we had a 10-year run from 2007 to 2017 where, you know, our shit didn't stink and I liked it. And that led me to a lot of other opportunities, you know, not just in the media, but also outside of the media. And one of those opportunities, kind of presented itself in the form of the ability to wager and gamble at extraordinarily high stakes. And the background of that is I've gambled since I'm 7 years old. It was always a part of my life.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
You weren't aware of that, right?
I didn't know that you and I used to do that together on the weekends across the nation, but go ahead.
Well, if we're telling true stories, so I will tell a true story from Philadelphia. So Ham and I are living in Philadelphia. Like you said, a bunch of knuckleheads not making much money. And we're wagering on college football games, pro games, like what average, like nothing really out of control. If it was $1,000 bet that a few of us were splitting up, that would be a lot. And I'll never forget, we had a bookie in Philadelphia named Big Lou. And we decided on one Sunday night that we're putting $1,000 on an Indianapolis Colts NFL football game. And we lost. And we were like, man, $1,000. I don't know if we were getting $1,000.
I didn't have $1,000.
Yeah. But I remember that when we called Big Lou, the bet was being made by Hamilton, not by me. And I was the middleman in theory, to at least as far as Lou understood. And the terminology in the gambling world for a $1,000 wager is a dime. So I said, Hamilton wants a dime on the Indianapolis Colts. We lose the bet. And he goes, all right, you owe me $1,100. That's the bet plus the 10%. You're VIG. And I said, I go, Hamilton told me he only bet $100 on that game. And back and forth. And yeah, we paid him $100 and he took it. And that was the end of it. But fast forward, you know, well beyond that.
I still don't know how the hell we got away with that, by the way. I thought we were going to get killed.
Yeah, well, he wanted the $100. That's
by the way, I still, Big Lou's on LinkedIn and he's reached out to me a couple times.
Well, avoid him.
Hey, yeah,
you owe him $1,000.
I hope he never listens to this. Go ahead.
So fans, look, obviously it's hard to get into the nitty gritty at all, but long story short, I'm now a big success in New York City. The show is, like I said, very popular. I'm making tons of money doing it, and I've kind of realized my career goals. Like, this was the dream. you'll be successful on radio / TV in a major market. It's where I come from, New York City, and like life is great. And I have all the trappings of success. If I want something, I can buy it. If I want a car, I can have a car. If I have the crazy apartment, I got it. The beautiful country house, got it. And then along with that, you know, as my ego, you know, grew and grew more out of control, because I wound up being surrounded by a lot of kind of yes men and women. People want to blow smoke up my ass and feed into my ego. It allowed me the opportunity to now also do other things, whether it's business opportunities or gambling opportunities. When there's one day on the radio where Boomer and I were going to do our show, we did it once a year from the Borgata Casino in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I said to him kind of flippantly one day, about a month or two before we're going to do the broadcast, if you give me $10,000 in cash, I'll turn it into $25,000 and I'll guarantee it. And I was like, a whole big to do. No one can guarantee a return in gambling. And it went on for a period of about 4 to 5, 6 weeks, where it became a big part of our show. And now here's the lead up. We're going down to Atlantic City. We're going to do this thing. And the day before we go down, he comes into the studio, no joke, with $10,000 in cash. And now what I thought might have been a bit, you know, we're just kind of BSing the audience, is now very real. Man, handshake, got to honor your word and your handshake. So he gave me, we counted out every $100 bill. He gives me the 10 grand, go down to Atlantic City, and I win like 80 grand that night. And the next day when we're doing our show, normally you'd have maybe 100 people come watch a live show at 6 o'clock in the morning in Atlantic City. And now I got like 1,000 people. Great. People just want to know, am I going to pay it off? And over the course of 4 hours, I slow played. He gets his extra 15 grand. So I guaranteed it. I paid it up. And now all of a sudden, I'm like the blackjack whisperer. Now,
worst thing that could have happened, right?
Yeah, for sure. Now, look, I was starting to gamble more and more anyway, but this very public wager that I paid off on now gave me access to more money. And what I mean by that was, I was a very good blackjack player. So that's part of it. And I thought I was the best player in the world. No one is, right? And because I did that, I became what I've referred to as like the blackjack whisperer amongst, you know, very wealthy men who have no problem saying, hey, I'll give you 100 grand.
Yeah.
You're going to give me a 10% return, 20% return. So I very quickly went from what I would say an average player from a financial standpoint with means. So I might bet 500 bucks a hand normally, recreationally, responsibly. And now all of a sudden, I've got 100 grand in cash on me. And now I've got 250 on me. And now I got a guy willing to give me $500,000.
Hey, hang on 1 second. I just leave that there because I want to go back to this, because I know some of this story and I know how it gets crazy and I want to hear that. But I want to go back to something you said, and I want the listeners to understand this. So, you know, there's this saying that celebrity goes to your head. And I think that Chris Rock has said, if you want to think you're an honest person and you're a good person, give yourself power or celebrity and then see how it works. And I actually saw this in you, because I mean, you and I were fucking nothing in Philadelphia, even though you had a successful show and I was successful in business. But I remember being in New York with you and walking down the street and busting your balls because people were coming up going, hey, Craig. And I was like, dude, this is crazy. So how did that celebrity and the fact that you were being recognized, do you think that played a part in all this shit and a part of you changing?
The recognition didn't. And I remember, actually, I'd say a fond memory now. You and I were on a subway in New York, and to bust my balls, you started saying, yeah. Are you Craig Carton?
Yeah.
Because it was weird for all of us. Like, right. Although I was known in Philly because I was on the radio, I wasn't known at the level I became known, you know, in New York, and that's, you know, bigger market. Being recognized didn't go to my head, but the celebrity went to my head.
Yeah.
You know, the people wanting a piece of me, wanting to be involved in my world, you know, the fawning over me, the stuff that came with success, for sure, went to my head, because you're in New York City and now you're on TV, on the radio, and you are recognized wherever you go, and people want to give you things and do things with you. And that's like a drug in and of itself, you know, that level of power.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. And if Michael Jordan happens to listen to this by some wild fucking chance, I apologize, Michael, because you know how I feel about him, buddy. But I've heard he's an asshole. And I kind of give them a break. I mean, if every 5 minutes somebody was coming up to me telling me I was the greatest person in the world and I could do whatever I want, I'd probably be a fucking asshole too.
Yeah, I think part of it also is, and he's obviously at a totally different level than I was ever at, but you almost become, in a weird way, a prisoner of your own success, where you're very well aware that there are people in your life that are in your life because they want something from you, or you can do something for them, and they don't care about you. And the minute you get in trouble, or all of a sudden, you know, the party ends, and you look around the room's empty.
Yeah.
And I obviously experienced that once I got in trouble. But for me, it was, all right, I love playing blackjack. I did, regardless of anything, of the amounts. I enjoyed it. I was good at it. And now I've got people willing to give me obscene amounts of money to do it. So,
yeah, now you're at the point where you're getting tons of money. You're betting like crazy. Tell some of those, because I know some of these nutty stories about you going to the Bahamas and shit. Tell some of that stuff.
So the best example of the level of gambling I did and how important it was to me, like there were times like, you know, a guy gave me $1 million in cash, you know, duffel bag, you know, in a casino, and it's absurd. And I can tell you it's heavy. It's hard to carry. So when you get into that world, you're also now dealing with bad people. You know, the average really good, straightforward, honest businessman doesn't have $1 million in cash laying around his living room.
Really?
So you have to now understand that I'm now borrowing money from loan sharks, essentially, who want their 10, 15% return in 7 days. So you gave me $1 million on a Monday. That next Monday, I better have 1.1. And if I don't, it's a problem.
Yeah.
So the one blessing I have is that I always paid back those loans. I was able to pay those back, those loans. And I did have a very successful run for maybe, I don't know, 16, 18 month period. But to give an example, the height of my compulsion to gamble, you know, we were on a family vacation in Montana, going skiing. In-laws are with us. And it's no joke. It's like 5 below. It's not fun. And after a day or two, we all recognize this is not a place with kids to be because you can barely be outside. And I said, I can provide a solution in about an hour. And my solution was to have a Hollywood Hard Rock Casino send a private jet to Montana to pick us up. Now, along with that comes my promise to them that I'm going to wire them $500,000 that I'm willing to lose playing blackjack for also not sending me the private jet. Now, Hollywood Hard Rock was a place that I was very successful at. There's a lot of places I wasn't. In, you know, 7-figure success lifetime to date. So they were thrilled to get me back in the building, especially if I'm sending my own money as opposed to using their money. So they send a private jet. My family hated the fact that we went to casinos because it's not a place for kids. My wife's not a gambler and knew that, you know, I was certainly gambling too often, too much money, although she never knew the amounts. Private jet comes to Montana, picks us up. We go down to Hollywood Hard Rock. I tell everyone we have to stay one night or they weren't going to send the plane. In that one night in Florida, I lose the $500,000. While I'm in the process of doing that, I'm negotiating with Atlantis in the Bahamas to send me a plane to pick us up in Florida and to fly us to Atlantis. This is Christmas week, New Year's 2016 into 17. No problem. I have a marker at Atlantis, meaning they're going to lend me the money to wager with. If I win, great. If I lose, I got to pay them back in 45 days. I lose the $500,000 in Florida. They send a private jet for me to fly from Florida to Nassau, go to Nassau. In 3 days in the Bahamas at the Atlantis, I win $600,000. So now I'm up $100,000 on this trip. Then we decide, well, we don't want to stay in Atlantis for too long. Why don't we go to Bimini? Bimini is a small little sleepy fishing village. It's the westernmost island of the Bahamas. And we've been there once or twice before. It's very low key, laid back. They have houses on the beach, all that kind of stuff. Great place for New Year's. I convinced Bimini to send a jet to pick not just us up, but 18 other people from Philadelphia, my wife's and in-laws' friends. And I agreed to fly all them down. This is all on me, like my dollar, but it's all being comped by the casino.
Right.
So Bimini says they'll only do that for me if I send them $500,000. So when I win the $600,000 at Atlantis, I have Atlantis wire the money to Bimini, to Resorts World is the name of the place. And then they pick us up in a seaplane. They fly us from Nassau, the Bahamas, to Bimini for New Year's Eve.
And now I'm stressed out just hearing this shit.
Yeah. And now you have to imagine. Well, I'm also gambling.
Right.
I'm now trying to organize all this. I've got 23 people now coming to Bimini. Like, there's no mental break there. It's you right. pop, 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 one to the next, and you're swinging and dealing and wheeling, all that stuff. Long story short, I now have three homes on the beach in Bimini, all next to each other, 23 people. They sent a 737 jet to fly people into town for me. You know, that was like hooked up like a Sprinter type thing. And now I've got $500,000 to wager with in Bimini over the course of 3 days. So December 30th through January 2nd, I won $3.1 million. Biggest one I've ever had in my lifetime. 3 days, very hard to do at the limits I had to bet, which is about $10,000-$15,000 a hand. I can bet two or three hands at once, but yeah, I had the run of all runs. And as I look back on it now, I didn't tell anybody. I didn't celebrate. I didn't have a party. I didn't get a bag of cash and throw it on the bed like you might see in the movies. And I was a loner. And my gambling, which is similar to what I've heard from drinkers and drug users, the commonality there was I wasn't looking for the party. I didn't want attention. Like, they wanted to put me on the cover of some kind of blackjack magazine because I just did something that can't be done.
Yeah.
Right? And didn't celebrate it, didn't enjoy it. If you asked me what I did, I would have lied to you and told you I won a couple hundred grand. It was great. And that would have been that. I come back to home. No joke. A week later, I lose 600 grand in Atlantic City. And it wasn't, I didn't get pissed off or punch something or take it out in a tree. I just went about my business because I got to the point with my gambling where I felt in this cocoon of safety where I played as privately as possible. If there was a private room, I was in it. Yeah. I didn't want attention. I didn't want people seeing me. I recognized that the amounts I was wagering were totally absurd. And if someone saw Craig Carton wagering $15,000 a hand to blackjack, that's fucked up.
So I got a question for you. So you know my story. I mean, alcohol was my drug of choice. I did opiates. I did a lot of crazy shit when I was in Philly, but really alcohol became my cancer, my crutch, whatever it was. And I now know that I couldn't, like, I had to drink. If I didn't drink, I was this miserable freaking person. It became something that I couldn't live without. Do you feel the same way about gambling at that point?
Not that. To me, it was the only place I felt comfortable.
Yeah.
It was the only place I felt kind of at ease. And whether that was, you know, life's issues that we all have that are not unique to me, or the celebrity aspect you talked about, or the need to just be in a place where I can just be, for whatever the reason is, I describe it as a cocoon. And I've talked now, and I couldn't express it 5 years ago. I can express it now, where I have distinct memories of any time I was going to go to a casino. As I approached the casino, I felt the full change in my body.
That's normal, dude. Like, it's the same thing. Dawn, my wife, would say, we would go to a restaurant, and the second I would order a dirty martini, she said, before it even got delivered, I became the gregarious, crazy Hamilton. I was happy.
I remember I walked differently. I had like an extra little gait to my step when I hit the casino door. Like, the thing is, I didn't know it at the time, but looking back on it, it was tangible. So long story short, I'm in that crazy world. I'm winning and losing shitloads of money, far beyond my means. I obviously experienced great successes. Obviously, have 7-figure losses as well. And I'm associating now with some people that I shouldn't have been associated with, and making bad decisions in gambling. Then carried over to just making bad decisions outside of gambling in life. Whether it was going into business with people that weren't all that, you know, trustworthy. Hanging out with those people and just things like that, which I was well aware not right. And these are people I'd otherwise never allow in my home. I'm now engaging with these people like they're you, like they're friends, like they're people I can trust, people in my life. And they weren't. There's people I just met. These are surface friendships at best. And now I'm writing checks for this business and that business. And the business I got involved in were all up above board and legit, legal, and each one of them on their own probably would have or could have been successful, but I'm doing 17 of those businesses all at once.
Disclosure, for those that don't know Craig, I've good enough friends with Craig. You always had a little bit of that in you. You always, I mean, you and I would go to restaurants and you'd order everything on the fucking menu. And you remember when we built a putting green in our backyard and broke the glass of the rental car? Yeah. I mean, we were always doing harebrained shit, but you always had this innate desire to have your hands in about 1,000 different things. And then when you add addiction on top of that, it's crazy.
Yeah, you're right. Like we always had something going on extra beyond whether it was pharmaceutical sales or being on the radio. And for me, the worst thing, again, looking back on it with clarity now, was free time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had tons of free time. You kind of were your own boss back then. I only worked 4 hours a day. We had time to fuck around and do what we wanted. And when you're in your mid-20s and life's not all that serious, you do stupid things. And then, you know, you like to think when you're 45 or 50, you stop doing stupid things. I didn't. I'm sure to a certain extent you didn't.
Yep.
So gambling, for me, it's interesting. Gambling, I think, my addiction to gambling, I think, just opened up a door that I might have opened at some point anyway. It just expedited the opening of it. Yeah. And that was just making ridiculously stupid decisions and deciding somewhat consciously, somewhat subconsciously, that all the things I'd worked so hard for and all the things that I knew were important to me, people and tangible objects, just weren't important anymore because they all took a backseat to my ego. And my ego manifested itself specifically through gambling. And then I got into this one deal, without getting too into the specifics of it, which it turned out, you know, got me in enough trouble where I had a criminal trial, was accused of, you know, different levels of fraud and fought it, didn't take a plea deal, wasn't offered a plea deal, and spent all the money I had defending myself and wound up losing. And I always said the reason, and again, I want to be clear, I wasn't offered a plea deal. I was accused of wire fraud. Was that I never wanted to raise my hand and say publicly that I was guilty.
Yeah.
The jury said I was found guilty. I could live with that. I disagreed with it, but I was never going to stand up in a courtroom and say that I knew what I was doing was illegal and that, Your Honor, I'm guilty. And I was willing to spend every dollar I had not to do that.
So let me ask you a question. And I don't know if you want to answer this question on a public forum or not, but when you look about it, because you're in a much different place now than you were then. And I know that, and I've seen your transformation, and I can talk about that either now, or I think we need to do another episode because we don't have a ton of time left. Do you now look back and what they accused you of, do you feel like, I mean, I know you realized that what you were doing was nuts and you shouldn't have been doing it, this and that, but do you agree that you were wrong with what they accused you of, or is that something you don't even want to go into?
I don't want to get into all the specifics of it right now. We can maybe at a later date. I'm still dealing with certain governmental issues, so I'll pass on that. But I would just say I was doing enough things wrong or things I shouldn't have been doing. The actual facts and the truth of what I was accused of, I don't think have ever been presented publicly. And there'll be a day when I will do that. And I'm happy to do it with you. But I'll say it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I was involved with bad people and I was doing enough wrong things, whether they were illegal or not, where it was only a matter of time before a major, major, you know, shoe dropped on me right in my head. And this is just the manner that it did. And I can also tell you that if that hadn't happened, I don't think I'm sitting here today.
Yeah.
And I know that's somewhat cliche to say, oh, you know, the worst moment of my life, losing my freedom, might have saved my life. I don't know if I'll go that far, but pretty damn close.
Yeah.
Pretty damn close. I was on a bad road. I was on a bad track for sure. That would have blown up in some manner, in a negative way for sure.
Well, what's amazing for, and you and I talked about this briefly a couple months ago. I mean, guys, I've known Craig, shit, how old am I, 54? I've known you for 31 years, and we've been phenomenal friends. We live together. We have another good friend that's been involved in this with us. And what I always say, I did see the transformation in you. And it was interesting. During that time, I actually remember a funny story. I came to your apartment in New York, and you threw like $45,000 worth of cash. You had it in a little thing. You threw it to me in a bag and said, feel this. And I didn't know what the hell you were. I didn't know anything was going on. But what I noticed about you through that time period, it was almost like you weren't there. Like we would be in the room together and we would be talking and there was nothing behind. And now I look back and I know it was because you were doing a million different things. Well, when the fall happened, we didn't talk a lot through that. I don't know if it was embarrassment or you were just trying to deal with it. But here's where I'm getting at. I had a conversation with you 2 months ago, and I think I told you, it's the best fucking conversation I've ever had with you in my life, ever. It was finally like, holy shit, this is the guy that I fell in love with as my best friend when I was 23 years of age. How the fuck did you get back here? So kind of walk us through, what was that transformation like? And you know what I'm talking about. How did you get there? Because I think a lot of people out there, a lot of people that listen to this are either struggling themselves or have family members that struggle. Just walk us through the transformation.
Yeah, well, first off, it doesn't happen overnight. That's for sure. My transformation, I think the beginning of it was getting on a plane to go out to Prescott, Arizona to a rehab center. And truth be told, I went to a rehab, a place called Algamist, for all the wrong reasons. I didn't go there to get help because I didn't want it.
Do you remember, dumbass, I picked you up and drove you there?
You were not ready to go. No, so you picked me up. We go out to this beautiful suburb, you know, in Arizona, in Prescott, Arizona, which is like the rehab capital of the world as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it is.
And we pull up to this, you know, kind of like a postcard house from the outside at least, right? And I don't want to be there. I made you stop. We stopped at a grocery store first because I thought, let me at least bring, it's like in, I call it inpatient. It's a residential house.
Yeah.
There's maybe eight people living there. And you kind of fend for yourself. They give you like $50 a week and you could spend on groceries and stuff. I go, let me be a good guy and just buy groceries for the whole house. So at least I ingratiate myself to these people I've never met before. And we go to this house and knock on the door and nobody there. And I'm like, all right, I'm out. Like, no, you're not out.
Dude, went into Craig mode. You started making phone calls. I'm not fucking going here. I'm out of here. You were trying to take control,
No interest in being there. I felt like I got myself an out there. They don't even know I'm coming. Fuck them. Take me to the airport. I'll find that tomorrow morning. I'll fly out. And you, based on your experience, like, just do me a favor. Make it one night. If you want me to come get you tomorrow morning, I'll come get you. That's what you said. And I was like, all right, fine. And whatever. So obviously I made it, but the journey of recovery for me, and I want to be clear, I went for the wrong reasons. The next day, 6 a.m, everybody's up, get in a van, go to the center where you actually have these like therapy meetings and whatnot. And there's about a dozen or so other people, men and women all across the country, gambling, you know, compulsive gamblers, you know, keno addictions, scratch off addictions, poker, sports, casinos. If there's a way to gamble, it's kind of all firmly represented by all these people. And I had always said prior to that, that the people in my life just couldn't possibly understand how I emotionally and mentally processed gambling and how great I was at it. You couldn't understand it. You don't do it. You're not at my level, right? And then one by one, I was the new guy, so I go last. They went around the room and it was like I had written a script and they had stolen my words and read it back to me verbatim, word for word. And what was fascinating about that to me was I'm betting $15,000 a hand of blackjack. This girl is putting $2 on a scratch-off. And it didn't matter. The amounts of money were irrelevant.
Right.
And it was, they described everything I felt emotionally and mentally and processed that I thought, like an idiot, was so unique to me. No one else has ever felt this way. I'm special. And that was the first thing I was willing to at least consider that maybe I have something going on. Before that, fuck you. I have no problems. You have all the problems. So I was there for 2 weeks. You know, I graduated their program. They said I was good to go and that gave me the tools I need to work with, you know, to better myself. And what I did from there was I got home. At this point, I'm somewhat estranged from my family because I'm being an idiot. And the first thing I did was go to a casino. Now here, I'm finally owning the fact that I've got a problem. I'm going to work on myself. And the first thing I do is go to a casino. And I went there to test myself. I brought $30,000 to a casino. I left half of it in my car. And my bet to myself was, if I lose the 15, I'm not going to the car to get the other money. I wanted to see if I could do it. Now that I've had this epiphany,
right,
that maybe I have a problem. And obviously, very long story short, I go to the car, I get the money. Money's gone. That's the last day I ever made a wager. The day I lost a bet with myself.
And you know, I didn't know that story. I didn't know that part.
Yeah, because there's still an ego in there because I'm at the very early stages back then of acknowledging I have a problem. But to answer your original question of, you know, the journey to get to where I'm at today, where I've kind of found myself again, who I really am, who I always thought I was on the inside, is really just being able to admit that I had a problem and letting my ego go. And it's hard. I remember, you know, when you felt like you conquered drinking, you once said to me, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, that you're proud of who you are and you wear it on your sleeve. And that resonated with me. It was one of the times I came to visit you and saw you at the house. I remember you saying that you don't mind telling people that you're an alcoholic. And I was like, why the fuck would you ever want to tell anybody that? That's like, you're admitting you're weak. You're admitting you've got flaws. Good for you, but I'm not there. And then this is well before, obviously.
Right.
But it resonated with me because, you know, I carried great shame with it. You know, I fucked everything up. I threw everything away. I ruined everything, not just for me. You have kids, wife. You ruin everyone's life. You don't just ruin your life, whatever the addiction is. So I think for me, the slow steps were finally acknowledging that everyone else around me is right. I'm the one that's wrong. That I got to leave my ego at the door because I ain't that cool. And now acknowledging that it's okay to open up and be vulnerable to people and let them inside a little bit and help you. Because I don't want anyone's help. And I think for me, the journey, which it probably took a while, obviously, was being able to look you in the eye and say, yeah, I'm a compulsive gambler. I got a problem.
Yeah.
And ask for help. And I met a guy, because I hate therapists, you know, prior to all this, I don't want to sit down with a therapist.
Just so you know, and for any therapist working out there, we'll tell you, that is the biggest reason that people don't get help, because it's so scary, because most people don't want to talk to a therapist. Now, therapists that are out there, you're great. We love what you do. It's just, it's a really hard thing to get started on.
No, and I thought I was smarter than every therapist I talked to. And I, you know, whatever. I felt like I'm playing. If I got to give you $200 to play you, I will, you know, just to appease other people.
Right.
And I met this guy named Ron Hanover. I was now retired, whose experience as a therapist was really focused on two places, convicts and military veterans. I was not going to bullshit this guy.
Yeah.
Right. And he let me know from Jump Street, you think you're cool, you think you're this and that. I've seen it all. I've heard it all. And he called me on every piece of bullshit I fed him. And over the course of a couple months at first, I respected the hell out of him. And I was willing to talk to him man to man.
Yeah,
and we didn't always talk about gambling. We talked about life. We talked about whatever, you know, kind of floated my boat or his boat on a given day. And I saw him every week for damn near 5 years.
Wow.
And he was a big part of my transformation and change and my willingness to also go home and be more open with family members. Like, I sucked at sharing feelings and emotions. I bottled it all up.
I know where that comes from.
Yeah. Hi, Dad. So that was... So I had this really cool thing happen where I think in addition to kind of conquering, which is a daily thing with, you know, the gambling, conquering the addiction, which like I said, it's been 5.5 years since I made a bet and I know I'm not going to wager today. And I feel like I've got it under total control. I was also able, I think, to become a more complete person.
Yeah.
Now that sounds kind of cliche and silly or hyperbolic, but it's like I cry when I see something emotional on a TikTok video.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, what are you crying for? Oh, she's crying. So I'm crying, that kind of thing. So I think, very long story short, my message is I view it this way. Robert Downey Jr. said this at some award show a couple of years ago. And now, like you, I'm sure, like certain quotes or hear people say things, certain things stick, some obviously one ear out the other, it just doesn't mean anything to you. But he made a comment that stuck with me that I now live by and I think is very accurate. And that is, overcoming addiction is not hard at all. Wanting to is. And that stuck with me because once I decided I wanted to, not gambling was easy.
Yeah.
Because I'm committed not to do it. It was getting to the place where I wanted to stop gambling and recognize all this other shit is far more important than me sitting at a table by myself for 8 hours. You're counting cards.
Well, the hardest thing, Craig, is if everybody could feel the way you and I feel today, everybody would do what you and I did. The problem is it doesn't seem real. Like, I remember people telling me, oh, when you get into recovery, it's the greatest thing in the world. I'm like, fuck you, dude. I'm going to get drunk. It just was. But I look back at my life and I've been pretty successful and there's nothing pales into comparison to me beating alcohol, whatever you want to call it. And I look at your life and you've been extremely successful. I've been there with you along the journey. You're recognized all over the place. And to me, and I don't know if you probably feel the same way, but I've never asked you. To me, I'm more proud of you I would be more proud of you if I was you for where you are today than any accolades, awards, Boomer Esiason bullshit, any of that stuff. Because this is what really matters.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I'll give you an example. So for the going into year four now, I do a public service show every Saturday morning on the radio in New York City called Hello, My Name is Craig. And every week I talk to fellow compulsive gamblers because my goal in life now is to help humanize, you know, the addict. So people don't look at us as quote unquote degenerates, that it's your mailman, your librarian, your teacher, yep, your cop, all that stuff, right? And I just did an interview yesterday with the New York Times, who's doing a feature on this show that we do. And I've had all the radio success you could ever possibly have. I'm blessed. And I do this half hour show every Saturday. I don't care about the ratings on it. And I'm into year four, and it's the best content I've ever produced and the most important content I've ever produced. I'm not going to get an award for it. I don't get paid to do it. I do it for free. Yeah. I get nothing out of it other than the satisfaction of it lets me continue to tell my story. It lets me help other addicts or friends and family of addicts, maybe see the signs of someone and let them get help. And it's the best radio and the most important content I've ever done. And I'm more proud of that than I am of any award I might have on my shelf, any ratings, any bonuses, money, all that stuff. So yeah, I'm with you on that. I've become more spiritual too. And if I'm put on this planet by whatever you want to consider your, you know, higher being, to be a messenger to help other people, well, I'm in. And I like doing it. I get joy out of doing it.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, listen, we're running out of time. This has been awesome. I would love for you to come. There's so much shit we didn't even cover. Do you still have the foundation for Tourette's? You don't?
No, we used to, once I got in trouble, you know, it's hard to ask people.
But I do want to talk about that a little bit at some point. There's just so much shit. You and I, our backgrounds are very similar, but more importantly, I'm proud of you, my friend. It's awesome. And I know your message will inspire a lot of people, but maybe next time, if you show up on time, we can do more.
I forgot we were doing it.
Yeah, I know you did. You dumbass. Liz is like,
I was in the car, I was driving. And I saw the email this morning because I did ask you guys to email me the day after to remind me because I suck at that. And as I'm pulling into the driveway, I got your text like, hey, are we doing this? And so I apologize. No, I want to make one thing clear. I just want to say one thing. I only brought up values of dollars and money because you asked the question.
You're fine.
I try to be clear about that. You know, I don't glorify that at all.
No, I get it.
It shouldn't be. It's more about the mindset, like, of doing the things I did because the money was irrelevant to it.
Yeah.
It was the need and desire to gamble. So I just want to be clear for anyone watching this, I'm not bringing up figures because I want to brag about it or let people know about it. The amounts of money are totally irrelevant to the addiction. I just want to be clear about that.
Yeah, just so you know, I appreciate you saying that, but anyone that listens to that is not going to feel that way. And listen, I could always talk about the time that me and Steven went out in Philly. And I think the next morning he counted and said, I drank 36 Captain and Cokes in one night. So I'm pretty impressed by that, even though I don't drink anymore. That's the night he had to get me out of the bar because they said Evander Holyfield was about to punch me in the face.
I'll say this. If you get to the stage you're at, and I'm blessed to be at now, where you can look back on the shit we did and somewhat laugh at it and get a kick out of it. You know, every scar tells a story, right?
Yeah.
If nothing else, we're left with some good stories to tell.
Well, here's the thing. Everybody, there's this, my feeling about this whole shit is this, is they have all these sayings in recovery and we need to be real about this shit. Like there's a saying that says my worst day sober is is better than my best day drunk or best day gambling or whatever.
Right.
And like, I get why we say that. That's a fucking lie, dude. You and I had some incredible fucking times gambling, doing drugs, drinking, but it does pale into comparison to where we are today. So it's great to see you, my friend. Tell the family I said hi. We will be back in touch, and let's do this again.